Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane, your host for the show. The Astoria City Council had a very full agenda when they met Monday night. Today we'll hear about their discussion of the 20-year transportation plan and the possibility of restoring some two-way streets in the downtown core. The council also heard at length from the public about the new policy of selling surplus city property. 36 parcels are in the initial batch offered for sale. And then to round out the show, the history of an unusual joint venture between West Coast and Russian fishers during the late 1970s and 80s. We'll hear how the Russians taught the Americans how to deliver fish to trawlers at sea.
American fishermen not only hadn't worked with Russians before, they had never delivered their fish at sea before to anybody.
Ross Reynolds has the game-changing story. That's coming up at 9:21. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Over the past 2 years, City of Astoria staff and an appointed Transportation Advisory Committee have been working on a draft 20-year transportation plan. On Monday night, the Astoria City Council heard a presentation on the plan from Chris Majeski of DKS Associates, a Portland transportation planning and engineering firm hired by the city. In his presentation, he identified top concerns planners and Astorians identified in a series of community meetings. With an Astoria bypass not likely to be funded in the next 20 years, one alternative citizens and planners are considering is whether some downtown streets should be changed from their one-way designations. Other considerations are how to improve cross-town traffic flow and improve pedestrian safety and traffic flow on Marine Drive west of the downtown center and in the downtown core. The area of Commercial and 8th Streets has been identified as having the most congestion and traffic accidents. Majeski suggested more citizen involvement in whether to restore more two-way traffic to downtown streets. To do so would necessitate an upgrade of traffic signaling equipment on the state highway corridor. Council member Drew Herzig asked for cost estimates for both scenarios, making one-way to two-way changes and leaving the traffic flow as it is. Council member Russ War said he'd heard ODOT estimates for the upgrades were in the range of $1.5 million. Majeski then clarified that requiring signaling upgrades would need to be implemented in any case. Additional costs for a two-way conversion might not be too much more. Community Development Director Brett Estes, a member of the Transportation Advisory Committee, added there would be another advantage in making the cost studies.
Chris, just to clarify something, I think that may have caused some confusion. You're saying that we needed to include the upgrading of the signals in the plan. That right there would actually provide a placeholder for us to be able to receive state funds in the future if we include that in the plan.
Majeski agreed and said having specific projects in the plan would make it competitive for possible funding. Another specific proposal included altering Marine Drive, currently a four-lane road, to reduce the number of lanes to three, including a dedicated turn lane plus bike lanes. The change would allow enhanced pedestrian crossings with potentially some islands in the center. The road width would likely remain the same, with only one vehicle lane in each direction, leaving more space for pedestrians and bikes. Mayor Van Dusen expressed concern about commercial traffic and the proposed lane changes.
Well, that part concerns me a lot because for large trucks going on those lanes, it's very narrow now. And that street has a crown to it, and so the tall trucks lean to the side and they'll hit the power poles and the signs now if we narrow that.
Yeah. So the actual lane that a truck would be in, a single lane, could be wider.
That's what I was wondering. I mean, yeah. So it'd go from two lanes to one lane, but that one lane might be wider.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So if there are 12-foot wide lanes right now, it may end up being a 14-foot wide lane.
That's what I was hoping at first. And anyway, that's good.
Majeski acknowledged the change would result in somewhat more traffic congestion, but simulation models indicated although capacity would be somewhat reduced, gridlock would not result. Other safety improvement elements include the installation of sidewalks and street crossings on Highway 202 by Astoria High School. Roadway street lighting could also be improved. A citizen recommendation calls for a continuation of lane reductions through the S-curves at 8th and Commercial, with the traffic signal moved to 10th Street. In the area of Niagara and 7th, physical space in the street could be changed to reduce speeds, perhaps with mini roundabouts or curb extensions. Further highlights of the draft plan include an extension to Irving Street. The extension could provide an alternate highway route on the east side of town near Emerald Heights. City officials noted that ownership of streets in the area would have to be determined before moving forward. Federally owned streets in the Tongue Point area are in need of upgrades to city standards. Bond Street in the Slide area could be reopened to two-way traffic with the addition of traffic calming measures to ensure residents' safety. In all, there are 128 projects in the plan. Almost a third deal specifically with bicycle travel. Another third address motor vehicle or truck movements, with 20% for walking and 15% for crossings. Majeski explained costs for the draft plan proposals vary with the complexity of the projects.
When you turn that into what does it all cost and how does that break out by mode, that one-third of projects for driving becomes 75% of the cost in the plan. The 15% of projects that are crossing projects only cost about 1% of the value of the plan. There's a reason for that, and that is if you want to go upgrade a crossing, putting in signs, putting in striping, even doing something with curbs, is relatively cheap compared to building entire new street corridors with grading and foundations and the whole infrastructure. So the roadway projects dominate the cost for the plan. So what does that mean for the city? What can you afford out of all this? So of the 128 projects that are in there, it's almost $45 million. Looking at the revenue streams that you've been obtaining over the last 5 years on average, there's about $6 million of the $45 million that the city probably has coming in with your current revenue streams. So what that means is there's a lot of work to be done to partner with ODOT, to partner with other agencies, to look at additional revenue stream opportunities, to see if you can go beyond that small portion that's likely to be funded and see how much of this you can do over 20 years.
Monday night's presentation to the City Council was of a draft plan only. Final recommendations will be sought from the Planning Commission and Transportation Advisory Committee later this month before initiating the adoption process. The Astoria City Council also conducted some internal housekeeping during their Monday night meeting. Council member Drew Herzig was asked by Mayor Willis Van Dusen to speak to possible conflicts of interest regarding council member service. First regarding Herzig and the Friends of the Astoria Armory, then regarding communications regarding Russ War and the local business Astoria Granite Works. The mayor also addressed etiquette or protocol in the running of council meetings. Drew Herzig addressed the council about his dealings with the Armory and the Friends of Armory group.
I'm going to have to go into quite a lot of detail, so I ask your patience on this. Thank you. Early in October 2013, I was invited to attend a meeting on Friday, October 11th. The purpose of the meeting was to form a board of directors for the Friends of the Astoria Armory, then organizing as a 501c. Prior to this meeting, there was no board of directors. The meeting took place at Craft 3 offices in Astoria. There were no City of Astoria staff present at this part of the meeting. At the meeting, I was invited to be on the board of directors of the Friends of the Astoria Armory. I told those present that I could not accept the invitation until I was sure that it would not create a conflict of interest. I was advised to check with the city attorney. Later that afternoon, after being away from home, I returned to find that I had received a voice message from Mayor Van Dusen. In the message, he told me that he had heard that I was on the board of directors of the Friends of the Astoria Armory. He expressed concern about the appearance of a possible conflict of interest, but acknowledged my right to do as I thought best. I sent an email in reply to the mayor late Friday afternoon. In that email, I said I would get off the board immediately if there were any possibility of a conflict of interest. It would have been more accurate to have written that I would decline the invitation to be on the board, but since the mayor was acting on the rumors that he had heard that I was already on the board, I felt it would be addressing his concerns more directly to use the wording, get off the board. On Friday late afternoon, I also sent an email to the city attorney and city manager requesting their opinions. I thought about the situation overnight and on Friday called the president of the Friends of the Astoria Armory Board of Directors and told him that I felt I must decline the invitation to be on the board to avoid even the appearance of a conflict of interest. I then sent an email to Mayor Van Dusen telling him that I had requested that my name be taken off the list of the Friends of the Astoria Armory Board of Directors. Again, it would have been more accurate to say that I had declined the invitation to be on the board. Since the two emails to Mayor Van Dusen, I used the terms get off the board and name taken off the list of the board of directors, I can understand that some people might have taken these words to mean that I was actually on the Friends of the Astoria Armory Board of Directors from Friday, October 11th to Saturday, October 12th. Two points I would like to emphasize. Firstly, during that period from Friday, October 11th to Saturday, October 12th, the only time period when I might legitimately be considered to have been on the Friends of the Astoria Armory Board of Directors, I did not attend any Astoria City Council meetings or executive function sessions. The board did not exist prior to October 11th, and therefore I could not have been on any board during any City Council meetings or executive sessions at any previous time, either in July, August, September 2013, or at any other time. Secondly, as my initial email to Mayor Van Dusen demonstrated, I never refused to resign from the board. Thanks for your patience.
Mayor Van Dusen then asked Herzig if he had relayed any information learned in City Council executive sessions to Friends of the Armory members during his meetings with them. Herzig answered no. Then Mayor Van Dusen told the council he had not at any time asked Herzig for his resignation from the City Council. Mayor Van Dusen then moved on to the issue of Councilmember Russ War and the Astoria Granite Works. Councilmember Herzig told the council he had contacted the Oregon Ethics Commission to question whether Herzig himself could vote on a no-bid contract involving a fellow council member. Herzig stated his communication with the Ethics Commission was only to ascertain his own ability to participate in the vote. War's name was not mentioned in the communication. Councilmember Russ War then said he would let the incident go as a misunderstanding. Finally, the mayor addressed council meeting protocol. The mayor stated his opinion that Councilmember Herzig had exercised poor etiquette in his tendency to ask audience members if there were more questions and directing people to the podium. He stated the behavior led to questions as to who is running the meeting. Herzig explained his own concern was to make sure attendees fully understand the proceedings and feel included in the process. The mayor then said going forward, he would be sure to run a tighter meeting. A transcript of Herzig's statement about his communications with the mayor about the Friends of the Armory organization can be found on our website, coastradio.org. Just click the news button. Still ahead, in Astoria, 150 surplus city-owned properties are being considered to be sold off in the coming year, but the sales process is off to a rocky start.
When we did the first advertisement to adjacent property owners, there was a lot of concern because the letter that went out gave what citizens felt to be a very short response time.
We'll hear how the city is addressing that and some of the other public comment about the sales process. That story coming up right after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Rain and isolated thunderstorms this morning. Showers this afternoon. The rain may be heavy at times this morning. The National Weather Service in Portland forecasts windy conditions through early this afternoon for coastal communities. A low-pressure system will move eastward into the Puget Sound today, producing 45 to 55 miles per hour wind gust across the Willapa Hills and the North Oregon and South Washington coast this morning through at least early this afternoon. Very isolated gusts of 55 to 60 miles per hour will be possible along the beaches and headlands, but widespread damaging winds are not expected. A few isolated thunderstorms are also possible as the front moves onshore this morning. The chance of precipitation is near 100% with rainfall amounts a half to three quarters of an inch possible. High temperatures today in the low 50s. And tonight, the winds will die down, but still a 70% chance of precipitation with showers likely. Overnight lows around 45. The city of Astoria has begun the process of surplus property sales. City officials say 150 parcels are targeted for sale in the next year. Hundreds of properties could eventually be sold, adding to the tax base and generating revenue. Astoria real estate firm Area Properties is representing the city in the sales. So far, offers have been made on several properties, but as citizens and adjacent property owners become aware of the sales, concerns are being raised. As City Manager Paul Benoit told the council, complaints from adjacent property owners have resulted in changes in the sales process.
One example is when we did the first advertisement for adjacent property owners, there was a lot of concern because the letter that went out gave what citizens felt to be a very short response time. We acknowledged it was a short response time, and we're working to expand that. I think all the property owners in the first round have been notified. They have more time. And if the council continues with this process, we'll send a letter out that, again, you can review before we send it out, but it'll give several weeks for people to respond.
Astoria resident Bob Goldberg spoke up to ask how properties came to be included in the initial sales list, how to find out about land sales as they occur, and what the city will do with the proceeds of the sales. City employee Mike Morgan stated the city cross-checked the inventory of buildable lands with a coded list of city-owned properties that could potentially be sold to come up with the initial list of 36 properties out of a potential 1,300. Then City Manager Paul Benoit addressed the disposition of sales proceeds.
So where the funds go from, in the past, all sale of city property, the funds derived from those sales go into the capital improvement fund. Because they're one-time money, you only sell property once, so we historically have never used those funds for operations. They go into the capital improvement fund, and it's used to replace capital equipment, police cars, fire equipment, computer systems. That sort of thing. Now that's a city council policy. City council can change that. If we go forward with this process, I think what we can do and should do is we can put a link on our website so that all, because I know it'll be on the MLS or it'll be, Area Properties will have something, but we could also create a page on our website you could go to and see what properties are being offered and which ones have offers on them.
Astoria resident Bernard Wood questioned the inclusion of geologically unstable properties in the sales lists. Planner Mike Morgan used a mapped parcel as an illustration.
The red area is a mapped slide of the city that encroaches into this city property. We will not, if the council approves, this slide portion of this entire city block will not be sold. So the proposal is that the adjacent owners that have made the offer on the property would like to buy the rest of the parcel to protect their view. And that's the sort of thing that we're doing with any property that has potential slide in the vicinity. Like I was telling Bob, the area at the end of Irving has, if you go up the end of Irving and you look down, there's a large drainage, that's a slide area. That could not be sold under the criteria.
Astoria resident Cindy Price suggested adding online lists or maps of city-owned properties and the buildable lot inventory. She asked if forested lands could receive additional consideration in the process. In concluding the discussion on the property sales, several council members expressed reservations on the process as it is. In order to address concerns from the public and council members, City Manager Benoit said the next step city staff will take will be to generate a single map of city-owned properties included in the buildable lands inventory and present it to the council at a later meeting. In the late 1970s and 80s, tensions between the U.S. and Soviet Union were peaking. Meanwhile, there was an unusual joint venture between West Coast fishermen and Russian fishermen. It's the subject of a new exhibit, Wild East Meets Wild West, opening on Sunday at the Pacific Maritime and Heritage Center in Newport, Oregon. Ross Reynolds has the story.
The collaboration between the fishermen from the rival countries was highly unusual for the time. Wally Pereira was the first U.S. general manager of the joint Soviet-U.S. venture.
And, of course, this was right at the height of the Cold War. We had Brezhnev on one side and we had Carter on the other. We had inflation occurring in the United States then. I mean, interest rates got up to, 16-18% or something. So it was a very difficult time. But American fishermen wanted to catch the fish and the Russians wanted to get the fish.
Here's how it happened. In 1976, the U.S. passed a law to extend control of U.S. waters out to 200 nautical miles. The goal was to stop overfishing, particularly by foreign fleets. The Magnuson-Stevens Act, as it was called, said that U.S. fishermen had top priority to fish within 200 miles, but the second priority went to joint operations between U.S. and foreign fishermen. Jim Talbot saw an opportunity. Talbot ran the Bellingham Cold Storage, a company that was buying fish, so Talbot hired fishery expert Wally Pereira to check it out. He quickly saw the potential benefits of working with the Russians.
The Soviet Union had this enormous fishing fleet. I mean, they were involved all over the world with these distant water fisheries and had something like 2 million tons of floating capacity.
And the Soviets knew some things about fishing that the Americans did not. Tony Allison worked on the U.S. side of the Marine Resources Partnership back in the early days of September 1978.
The Russians were the ones with the experience fishing for and processing these species. They knew where they were. They'd already fished for them for about a decade or a decade and a half before the joint venture ever got going. So they were the ones providing the knowledge.
The joint venture looked good on paper, but getting a deal was hard. Wally Pereira.
It was very, very difficult to work with the Soviets because they didn't fully understand how a marketplace worked. So the way in which they would determine things is through brute force. And so you had these acrimonious negotiations that would go on.
Eventually the deal was cut, but could the U.S. and Soviet fishermen work together? Tony Allison.
These people had never... Often an American had never seen a Russian before and vice versa. And you're on the high seas where a mistake can be very costly.
And it wasn't just the cross-cultural issues that had to be overcome.
American fishermen not only hadn't worked with Russians before, they had never delivered their fish at sea before to anybody.
The American fishermen had to figure out how to get their fish from their boat onto a Russian factory trawler, all the while bouncing around on the ocean. Nevertheless, the promise attracted a young Oregon gillnet salmon fisherman, Dave Frazier.
Between Alaska and the West Coast, millions of tons of fish available, and we were young and naive and thought, gee, this ought to work.
Wally Pereira was looking for people like Dave Frazier.
We called Wally up and said, gee, we'd like to do that. And he said, well, you need a boat, go build a boat. And that's what we did. We were green as grass, I guess you'd say, in terms of approaching a brand new fishery with a new gear type.
So Dave and his partners bought a boat, set out to learn how to catch bottom fish, and then how to deliver them to factory trawlers at sea.
And so it was a unique kind of experience that an exchange between working Russian fishermen and working American fishermen, you know, not people that were trained as diplomats.
I don't remember any specific contradictions. Just because of two different political systems or different countries, really not.
Igor Besarab was the Russian deputy fish and fleet commander for the project.
Yeah, usual contradictions, not like between Soviets and Americans, but like between processors and catchers.
If you missed that last part, he said processors, that was the Russian factory trawlers, and catchers, that was the U.S. fishing boats delivering the fish. When they weren't working, the fishermen were hanging out. Tony Allison.
The American fishermen would almost always come onto the Russian boats, which were much bigger. They had a bakery. They had women on board often in some of the jobs. And we sit in the captain's, in the officer's mess and have food and vodka and tell jokes. I was often in the position of trying to translate these untranslatable fishermen's jokes, which ended up being quite similar.
The Russian ships had political officers on board. Their job was to make sure the Russians didn't get too familiar with the Americans. Igor Besarab remembers being instructed that when ashore, he should never accept refreshments from Americans.
Because they can put something in your drink and you can tell everything, even you don't know anything. You know, but it was stupid. Everybody understood that it is just crazy.
The Russian and U.S. fishermen were getting along, but not their governments. U.S. fisherman Dave Frazier.
One thing that really scared us all was when the Russians invaded Afghanistan in December of 1979. We were just a year into the fishery at that point. And here we thought, well, we built a boat for this fishery, and are we even going to have a market next year?
Have a market, they did. And it was a very lucrative market. Wally Pereira.
It was mind-boggling, really. I mean, we get up to... we were up to something like $250 million a year worth of product and fish. I mean, it was a huge venture.
The unusual experience fishing was also rich for the understanding it created. Tony Allison.
I think they experienced how similar fishermen are, no matter where they're from, or no matter what they've been told about the other side, like Americans were told about Soviets and Soviets about Americans. When they got out there, they found the common language very quickly, whether or not, I mean, they could do sign language or signal various ways, but they understood what they were fishermen.
Wally Pereira.
Fishermen getting together, working together, eating borscht together, eating little canned fish off the Soviet boats, drinking vodka together, toasting Solzhenitsyn, toasting Hemingway, the real men in our lives, you know. It was just amazing to see.
The U.S.-USSR joint fishing venture did not last. Eventually, the U.S. fishermen built their own factory trawlers. They did not need the Russians anymore. I'm Ross Reynolds.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. The new schedule for the show will be weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. We welcome your comments on the show. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's N-E-W-S, then the numeral 1, at kmun.org. I'm Kathleen Morgane saying thanks for listening today, and listen again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge.